House Judiciary Committee, Monday, June 27, 1977, Room 350. Public hearing and work session, 1:30 p.m., tape 82.
360. Committee will come to order. I understand we have one with me earlier on Senate Bill 662. Could you call it now? We'll take you, sir, and then we'll proceed to 361.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
My name is John Weiser. I'm a lawyer for Union Pacific Railroad Company in Portland, Oregon. And we have supplied for the committee copies of 49 U.S.C. subparts 5B and 5C, which are mentioned in this amendment that is embodied in Senate Bill 662. I could go into just a brief statement on what 5B and 5C are. These were the 5B was the original Reed-Bullwinkle Amendment to the Interstate Commerce Act, which allowed what they call bureau rate making or conference rate making by carriers of all modes. And this incidentally was passed by Congress over a veto of Harry Truman in 1968, and it's remained virtually the same ever since. Then in February of 1976, a new subpart C was put into 49 U.S.C. What this did was to set up a special procedure for rail carriers alone, and it retains subpart 5B intact. So there are some rather more stringent requirements in 49 U.S.C. 5C, which pertain only to railroads, but it still does afford the same basis for carriers getting together and, in effect, legislating rates with the public being there and getting their input. And then they publish the rates with the Interstate Commerce Commission and also with the PUC. The rates at that time can be investigated or suspended and a hearing held if it's deemed to be essential by the administrator. If not, then the rates go into effect after a passage of a period of time, usually 30 days. That's just a very brief thumbnail sketch of what is authorized by the Reed-Bullwinkle Amendment, as has been expanded in the recent 1976 federal legislation. And what we're proposing in Senate Bill 662 is that the same exemption from state antitrust laws be afforded to this type of conference rate making as is afforded under the federal law.
I don't think I see any problem, Bill. Is there any such conference rate making? I should probably just say this, but I was distracted partly. Is there any such conference rate making that would not be involve interstate commerce, such that it would be in effect exclusively within the ambit of federal antitrust laws, were they otherwise to be applicable?
Well, usually they track one another. For instance, a tariff might be published that would cover all of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the movement of such a thing as wood chips. And so a rate from Salem to St. Helens would be included in that same tariff, which would be intrastate, and then one from Lewiston, Idaho to St. Helens, obviously be interstate. But normally, the same activities are taking place at the same time and in the same form.
Okay.
Chairman,
Representative Richards?
I'm afraid I might have been responsible for the delay in consideration of 662. I was concerned about a reference to a section of the U.S. Code without any setting forth in the bill of what provisions there might be in that code. Having seen what protections are built in the code itself, I could withdraw a motion that might be considered standing before the committee to include the provisions of the code and hope that we could supply the members of the House when we're voting upon this copies of this document.
Okay, now I have one technical question. It's a delegation issue. Mm-hmm. Technically, as it's now worded, the bill would appear to exempt from the operation of our state antitrust laws those activities conducted in accordance with 49 U.S.C. 5B or 5C. And as it's now ordered, the bill would not necessarily apply only to 5B or 5C as presently worded,
right,
but as they might be in the future amended by the Congress. I have a problem with that in terms of its benefit.
I checked with legislative counsel, Mr. Chairman. By case law in Oregon, all such references are
construed to
mean the law as it existed on the date that the bill became law, and that's all.
Well, that would, I think, have to be the intent of the committee in order to avoid the delegation question.
And further
delegation of our legislation.
Further, following up on Representative Frommeyer's suggestion that why don't we just state that in the bill, legislative counsel said that, again, to state it there would be to call into question all other references, cross-references, that don't state it. It's a matter of established and settled case law that's all you're saying when you cross-refer, referring to the
right
bill or whatever.
As long as that's not a problem.
Yeah, it's not a problem.
Is there further discussion? Is there a motion on the bill? Kindergarten.
Move the bill before it be passed.
Further discussion? Clerk, call the roll.
Frommeyer?
Aye.
Richards?
Aye.
Rutherford?
Aye.
Gardner?
Aye.
Meyer?
Aye. It is 5.
Thank you so much.
Let's go now to Senate Bill 361. Mr. Lowey. Let me ask, is there anyone here at this time who intends to speak on 361? I have received notice that there will be a further witness arriving probably within the hour. Anyone else here now on this bill? Okay, thank you. Same. Okay. You're also helpful. Thank you very much. We'll have to think of some questions since you're here.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Al Lowey. I'm an Assistant Attorney General, and with me is Richard Sandvik, an Assistant Attorney General. And previously distributed to you the Attorney General's statement on the subject of Senate Bill 361. This is an amendment to the Administrative Procedure Act.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Frommeyer.
I don't believe, Al, that I have your statement. Was it submitted to members of the committee?
Yes, it was submitted the last time this matter was up for a hearing. Representative Frommeyer, I didn't bring others. There's been a distribution made on it, and I'd assume that I think this was up for hearing one day last week.
It was.
Didn't get basically, and I statement isn't that long. I think I can state what the bill does. The bill has had some interest because it does arise out of our interpretation of some of the language of the Supreme Court in the opinion in Marbet versus Portland General Electric. There are two other bills, to my understanding, dealing with the Nuclear Facility Siting Council. This particular bill does not deal with the Siting Council. It deals with the Administrative Procedure Act, which, as members of the committee know, is across the board applicable to all state agencies. The bill really has two aspects. One aspect dealing with the participation, one aspect dealing with the participation of parties in an agency-contested case proceeding, and a sub-aspect of that, the request for judicial review of an agency order. The other aspect deals with the agency's rulemaking function. In the B. Engross Senate Bill 361, page 2 at the starting at line 32 and going over to line 6 on page 3 deals with party participation. There are three areas in which individuals may participate in a proceeding. Individuals, persons may participate in proceedings before an agency. First one, which is existing law, and I think no question, is those which the legislature has said those persons who are a party are necessary. Second one, those persons whom the agency considers should be a party in order that the agency may, even though not designated by the legislature, that the agency may have before it sufficient input and information to come to an informed decision. Really on page 3 of the bill, starting at line 1 through 5, is, I don't say it's a change, I prefer to refer to it as a procedural aspect, dealing with the question of participation of within a proceedings before an agency of persons who have neither been indicated by the legislature or that the agency has come to the conclusion should participate. This sets standards, rather broad standards. A person may request to participate if the agency determines that they have an interest in the outcome of the proceeding or represent a public interest in such result. This does not depart, I do not feel, in drafting the language, we do not feel that it departed from the language of Marbet versus Portland General Electric, but gave a structure to it. As I say, the standards are very loose, but we did feel that the agency should have some right, the agencies, all agencies, should have some right of saying, you don't have any interest. Please, or at least come in and show us what the basis of your interest in participating in the proceedings. Lines 3 through 5 indicate that an agency is determined to admit or not to admit a party to a proceeding before it is not subject to judicial review until the agency has entered its final order. Then the court may look at it. As our statement has tried to indicate, and I believe as a practical matter, an agency is certainly, if there's a colorable showing of an interest in the outcome or a representation of a public interest, the agency would be well advised to allow the person to participate on basis of that showing. Because if that decision was wrong, if a court ultimately came to the conclusion that the person did not have to be allowed to participate, probably would have no adverse effect upon the agency's final order. On the other hand, if the agency did not allow participation, and then a court felt that the agency had erroneously come to that decision, it would necessarily mean the matter be turned back and the agency go through the proceedings to allow that the participation from the interested person, and the agency then fully consider what standards they brought in.
Is the timing of judicial review on that question changed by this bill from the President?
Representing Myers, I don't know for sure, but I'm always much more secure when the legislature has spoken than when I'm trying to argue to the court. Now, we don't know whether it has changed. Maybe that would or would not be an appealable order, but then we look at the cases as to what are appealable orders, does it finally dispose as to that person. If we have a clear legislative statement that that decision, any review of that decision will be made after the entry of the final order, then we don't have to flounder around and worry about it.
Although I certainly agree, certainty should be, I see no reason there shouldn't be certainty. I'm just trying to get clear in my mind whether that's the extent it had been decided, whether this was a change from present law.
It has never been decided. I don't have, quite frankly, the past experience has been generally in advising agencies, if somebody wants to come in and talk, let them come in and talk. Within orderly procedure. So I don't have any decisions, and I think I'd probably be aware of one where someone has been denied, or contrary, which should equally be so, another party to the proceedings might say to the agency, we don't want that person in there, and you have let them in. We don't have any decisions whether that order would or would not be an appealable order. We've never dealt with the situation before. The Marbet decision kind of brings it up, and we are here saying, all right, let's lay out the certainty with which it, where it comes in. I could conceive of a substantial argument that either allowing or not allowing a party to participate is a final order appealable, which would, might or might not have the effect of staying the agency's proceedings. All we're doing here is really to try to say, this is what the legislature says, how it wants that to operate.
Person from where?
Yeah, Al, two questions for you on this same subject. When I first read the bill, I had some problem with the agency being able to determine whether the person has an interest in the outcome or represents a public interest, because that, of course, leaves open the question of whether the agency's picking sweetheart interest groups and wants to bring them in, and that's all. In the Senate was added the provision for judicial review, which to me makes a lot of sense. to have a judicially reviewable, and so that there's an independent judicial check on determining whether or not it's a legitimate public interest. And I think you ought to decide very quickly who's a proper intervener and who's not, otherwise you just have dilatory proceedings. So I'm with it as far as we go there. My question is why the appeal has to be from the decision of the agency on an appeal from the final order of the agency, where in at least some cases, and since you brought it up, it's obviously appropriate to point to a nuclear siting instance, where because the agency failed to admit a party who may or may not have been able to elucidate a single issue, you've got to run through the whole thing over again. What is in your thinking is making it a final appeal only on the final order as opposed to making it an interlocutory order, so that if the agency screwed up, boom, you've got a quick decision, hopefully, and you can get them into the proceedings without having to run through the whole validity of the final order into question?
I guess my answer to that, Representative Frohnmayer, would be that you make that an appealable interlocutory order. I don't know that you have that quick a decision. I can see what you're saying. We could draw a procedural aspect that we could draw a set of procedures in which there would be a fast affidavit showing and that review and then bring them back in. I'd argue practically, as we tried to point out in the statement, that the agency's going to let them in. And if they don't, they'd be well advised to, and would be strongly advised to, open up participation as much as possible. The alternative that you have suggested, I think, might have the opportunity of the agency saying, oh, well, let's bunk it to the court. And that still is going to be a delay. As soon as you step out of the agency proceeding before the court, you've got a delay.
Yeah, I understand that, but the stakes of the delay in some cases are less draconian because you can get earlier corrective action by, let's say, an appellate court. Or, you know, hell, you might even think about throwing an interlocutory appeal into a circuit court and make it appealable from there. What I frankly am interested in is first of all, making sure that a representative of the public who's an intervener and has a legitimate right to be there gets let in, and secondly, that not be a decision which ultimately causes the whole proceeding to be overthrown. If it's a 2 or 3 year contested case, as it could be in some of these biggies.
And in some of the biggies. That's why I don't object to the draconian characteristic of, as you've described it, of the appeal from the final, or the waiting until the final order is there. If the agency knows, then really the pressure on the agency is to say, well, we're going to go through all this work and we're going to come down with this final order, and just because we didn't think, oh, I don't want that sweetheart in there, we may have to do it all over again. Within the two choices, I would feel that this would be more, I guess what I'm saying, it would have the more practical effect of the agency saying, oh, yeah, let them in if they come in and show at any particular level. That's why the language we try to do, the language so, you know, he determines he has an interest in the outcome, or represents a public interest in such result. Now, we could say, let everybody in, without even putting any standard. Anybody just wants to come in and talk within an agency proceeding can be free to do so. My reaction to that is, I still think that agencies should have at least some area of saying, well, this clearly is not one that this resident of Honolulu has any interest in whether or not there's a liquor license in Vail, Oregon.
Mr. Chairman. Two more questions, Al. In drawing up the language on lines 1 through 5 on page 3, Al, was it your view that the agency should make its decision with respect to who has an interest in the outcome or a public interest in conjunction with the current law regarding standing to intervene that exists now in the United States Supreme Court or for the courts of Oregon?
Yes, I've seen standing arguments, in fact, in Marbet versus in nuclear facility. In that particular case, we got into a rather complicated, did not happen to be in, I was aware of it peripherally, standing question. I would see this language as being broader than what some of the standing decisions have been, and I hope that it would be.
Okay, now we're making important legislative history here, and you are the person at least who drafted the bill, and
that's
I want
correct.
To be clear that we're all agreed on what you are stating is the legal effect. And if I may paraphrase you, I think you've agreed that this at least codifies existing law of standing. You think it may be broader, but that the standard that the agency should use in determining whether or not a person has an interest in the outcome or represents the public interest would be the existing law of standing in the courts of this state or the United States Supreme Court or both.
Yes, I would agree there. If at least that is a minimum, and I would state that I feel that this language here makes it even broader than possibly the more narrower decisions.
So that if the agency's decision were on judicial review, since we have not stated what the standards for judicial review would be in lines 3-5, that they would look to that law of standing as the appropriate guide for what the agency should have done with respect to intervention.
Yes, if you're talking about judicial review of the denial or allowing of intervention, and of course, let me also add, remind again, I'm sure you're aware, but we're talking about the Administrative Procedure Act. If enabling legislation of any particular agency has either a more detailed in Energy Facility Siting Council, there is an area, you know, speaking about intervention. Look at other agencies in which the legislature has never spoken to it. Conceivably that, OLCC, we find people who, through notice, even though the legislature has never spoken as to the grant or denial of a particular license, dispenser's license within an area, OLCC is very, very open in allowing people to come in and participate. I've kind of gotten off the field, but what I'm saying is we have here the generality, then of course when we're dealing with or interpreting particular enabling legislations for particular agencies, there may be broader or conceivably more restricted. I can't think of
right, one. But that would have to be the specific statutory language of another specific statute that qualifies this otherwise applicable language.
Yes, that deals with that particular agency because of the recognition of the interests of the subject matter of that agency.
Okay, then to summarize before I may ask two final questions, Mr. Chairman. I think you persuaded me, at least with the legislative history that we've established here, that intervenors' rights are not going to be dealt with cavalierly, and that the legislative history is clear with respect to what court should have to apply. There's one practical problem and one, if not due process problem, at least one that problem of expeditiousness that could be taken care of. What would you think of a provision in these sections of the APA that would require the agency to give notice of contested cases in which intervention is expected in the administrative rule bulletin, as opposed to just giving it personally to those persons named as parties now? And let me explain the purpose behind the suggestion before you respond to it, Al. I think any contested cases are obviously cases between two parties or those parties that happen to learn of the case because it becomes a matter of public notoriety. Intervention is very important to some people, but they may not have notice of the case between the parties, which will decide not only that immediate case, but will also lay out policy that will govern decisions in future years, and that's explicitly according to the APA now, and while that decision reaffirms the agency's right to make a rule in a case that will apply to all future cases. What would you think of some provision that would permit notice of those types of contested cases to be given not merely personally to the parties, but also be given to the world, in effect, through notice in the administrative rule?
You've touched on a point that I have given some thought to, have not attempted to draft and take care of here, because I wonder, it's crossed my mind, and in discussion on this and in similar areas, it's the, I don't know what you're doing out there. Now, in rulemaking, when we are going classic rulemaking, we've made every conceivable effort to get the word out without being too paternalistic. As a general statement, I don't know how. I guess I have the difficulty of saying, at what point in the agency proceeding is the agency going to be able to figure out
that it is making a matter of general applicability. How does it know who cares? Certainly I could agree that contested case proceedings, and is this that contested case proceedings or proceedings in the nature of contested case should get, which come up, which may result in general policy statement. There should be some way to get as much information out that that's going on as possible. But I would suggest that that is probably more appropriately handled in enabling legislation. I'm crossing my mind right now a particular one that we are dealing with, critical groundwater areas up in Umatilla. We run that determination that this mining water, the Water Resources Board runs that determination as a contested case. But in its enabling legislation, it is required to publish. It has been specifically told that certain people, people with well drilling licenses and so on, shall receive actual notice. I find it difficult to conceive of a way to draft a general provision that would in turn have the effect of guiding the agency as to which areas or how to get the word out that it's dealing with something of generality. I think that that can best be handled in particular specific legislation. Such as my understanding, the Facility Siting Council does have certain requirements over and above the requirements contained in the Administrative Procedure Act, so that the determination of what it is doing within that area will get as wide a possible circulation. I guess my answer is I don't know that it would be appropriate in the Administrative Procedure Act.
How long is the typical notice of taking the contested issues that goes out to the parties in a contested case? I'm just trying to think of the administrative burden of printing a notice.
We haven't been in a contested case. We haven't been too specific because, of course, we're on an ad hoc determination. I'm going to take away, propose to take away surveyor's license. That process took probably 4 to 6 months, even the drafting of the notice. Proposed to suspend a beer dispense, wine and beer license for 30 days for sale to minors. That can be done 2 weeks to 10 days, depending upon, you know, how much time do you need to prepare to the nature, the complexity of the proceeding that is going there, going on. I don't know that this is the vehicle in which to take care of that, because I think that that kind of question is probably must be dealt with when we're dealing with the more precise question of the particular regulatory agency.
At some point in a contested case proceeding, though, the agency must be thinking, at least in some of the big ones, that it is now appropriate, we've gotten enough evidence, we've got enough interveners, that we feel confident that we can make a general rule for future cases. Or, that's not so alarming if interveners are there, but the case, I suppose, that is a theoretical matter bothers me is the one where the agency picks out a willing, friendly defendant and has a contested case, and then pops out a general rule as to which no one else in the world's had the right of comment, and yet it's now, they've effectively and legally, under the existing law, avoided the necessity of rulemaking, giving notice to the world, but they got a rule.
I have a rule.
Problem.
I understand that, and that's my understanding of the Pebble Springs decision. They have made a rule within that particular area allowing a substantial portion of intervening. An agency, however, in a one-on-one basis, and again we're dealing with a granting as against taking away. The granting problem is usually fairly broader. To say that the agency begins to get in, I'd say that the agency says, well, by gosh, this has got to be our general policy, and we've been placed in this fact situation, and announces it within the order in that particular contested case, and I come along later and say, making an application, they say, that's our rule, because we announced it in this case in which you didn't participate and nobody else participated, I, on behalf of my client that would be subject to that, would have, under existing law, Sun Ray Dairy number 1 and others, fellas, you may have made that ruling in that particular case, but if you're going to apply it to me as a generality, you haven't gone through rulemaking procedures to apply that as a generality, as a rule. Even though an agency makes a statement, as the Marbette versus PGE decision says, in a particular fact situation, let's get down very basic. Agency decides that the barber's board decides that comb should be sterilized to X degrees within a particular proceeding. The general language is, and I don't know what it is, but let's make it up. Let's say that they may revoke or suspend a license for failure to meet with sanitary standards. And then they make the determination within a particular proceedings for the suspension of a particular barber's license that homes must be sterilized to X degrees. And the court may say, all right, agency expertise, the sterilization temperature is such and such. We will affirm this suspension because it's within your mandated authority. Comes along my next client. We're going to get you on it because that's the rule we made. I think that I would certainly use Sun Ray and some other arguments that you have not articulated a standard, assuming that it's just a broad general delegation. We must also remember, of course, that in Marbette versus Pebble Springs, the court said the legislature has told them to go through certain processes to adopt these particular standards. And that moves us again out of the Administrative Procedure Act into a particular enabling legislation.
Yeah, I'll come to that in a minute. One final point then. What happens when the agency gets 110 interveners, either under existing law or if we were to pass this bill? Does the agency have power to consolidate or force consolidation of the interveners if they don't have 110 lawyers cross-examining the same witness?
Yes.
Or do you think the agency would be risking error and reversal on that?
No, I do not believe that the agency, I would not have any objection to defending an agency upon saying, doing, as a matter of fact, what Mr. Sandvik and I have kind of worked out, and I believe if such a problem arose in which there was a blank, procedural blank, by rule adopting the equivalent of a pre-hearing conference, equivalent of a conference to narrow down the issues. As a matter of fact, the one-stop permit division of the Executive Department has, with an indication to adopt such rules, has adopted certain rules about, okay, you've got all these problems, let's get this down and narrow the issue down. I believe that agencies in a contested case hearing have more than adequate, if not explicit, certainly implied authority to say, all right, here are 110 interveners, and I would also point out that the very, clutching at a straw, if I don't know if I need to, but the very authority to determine the right to participate and to ask the proposed intervener to say why, whether he has a personal interest or a public interest. The agency can then look at the 110, look at the basis of their request, and say, all right, people, you all seem to fit into this slot. You get together, and we will hear you upon that area. We can't legislate orderly handling of a proceeding, and we shouldn't have to. That's going to be up to the agencies. If they don't have the thought and attention to set their hearing and run it in good order, why, then they should be in trouble. But I don't believe they would be reversible. Their final order would be subject to reversal if they showed an intelligent and reasonable basis of getting the material down and to in an orderly form so that they could get the data they wanted.
Well, if I may just reply to that, or at least open up a question now. What we've done with interveners is define them the same as parties. That is, they are now part of the substantive definition of a party. And what I don't have before me is the rest of the APA with respect to what the rights of parties are, which might preclude some of what may be very sensible consolidations of issues and of persons and of counsel.
Mr. Sandvik had a comment.
Mr. Chairman, could I elaborate on that answer, Representative Frommeyer?
Yeah.
There's only one provision in the existing APA that talks about non-parties, in effect, interveners. In ORS 183.450, subsection 3, there's a sentence that says, participants permitted to intervene by the agency shall have such rights as determined by the agency by rule or otherwise. As a matter of fact, I don't want to give this too narrow a focus, but my experience is dealing with the Siting Council, because I have represented them and their predecessor. The Siting Council does have a procedural rule that authorizes consolidation. And in the Pebble Springs case, the Nuclear and Thermal Energy Council did consolidate the two interveners who had a common interest in one issue having to do with the transportation of radioactive waste. And as I recall, the Supreme Court in the Marbette decision didn't think that was untoward. I know there was expressed comments in the decision that the agency had the right to limit interveners as to what issues they were going to participate in. And as I recall, and I'm just trusting the memory now, there was a comment to the effect that this consolidation had been accomplished and the court didn't see anything wrong with it. So I think with that existing statute, an agency would be free to adopt rules which would authorize consolidation in order to conduct an orderly procedure.
That's where I'm now beginning to have some questions, Dick, because
Dave, you haven't defined consolidate. What is he talking about? I'm sorry.
Well, you've got 110 different people who want to intervene. And the agency says, okay, we can see some colorful public interest that you represent, so come on in. And they'll say, we've got 110 lawyers. We all want to cross-examine each nuclear physicist or each DEQ sanitary engineer or whatever the particular agency has to be. Now, that's no way to run a railroad. And the question is whether or not the APA can, or this amendment of it, broadening the rights of interveners, as some claim, at least keeping it the same as others claim, whether or not there's any way procedurally to deal with what would otherwise be a terrible
problem. Are you saying would include within that is the right to determine, I mean, if 110 of them all have, it's found by the agency that have the same interest, that they can say, elect which one of you 110's lawyer, attorney is going to speak and cross-examine?
Well, that's what Dick and Al are saying. And my question is whether or not that is a result of the statute as we're amending. And the reason I say that is that, Dick, what you just pointed to was a definition of what the rights of interveners are. Would you cite me that right again very quickly?
ORS 183.450, subsection 3. Second sentence of that subsection.
ORS
183.450.
Hold on. 183.450, subsection 3. All right. Now, here's where I think there's a drafting mistake in 361 as it's before us, which is that you have assimilated the rights of interveners to those of parties by defining as parties those persons whom the agency allows to intervene. So you've actually jacked them up one procedural step and given them all of the rights of parties as they now exist in the APA.
Consciously. The distinction between the distinction between an intervener and a party, I find one to be a rather limited one. Once the individual is in there to participate for within a contested case hearing. Now,
okay, then if I just may continue looking at the rights of parties in contested cases and evidence 183.450 sub 3. Every party shall have the right of cross-examination of witnesses who testifies and shall have the right to permit rebuttal evidence. Looking at what they're entitled to under notice in 183.415 sub 3, parties may elect to be represented by counsel and to respond and present evidence and argument on all issues involved.
Mm-hmm.
So once you're a party, I don't know that the agency can afford to have you consolidate at all. Unless you're going to be giving up your statutory rights here. And that's because of assimilating definitionally interveners as parties, rather than giving them what some people might argue are subsidiary but important rights that you just filled out for me in
sub 3. Participants are permitted to intervene by the agency, so that's right, as determined by the agency by rule or otherwise. I can only say, and I'm only speaking from experience, I see the distinction you're making. You're saying that an intervener has possibly something less than a party. A party is that which either the legislature has determined, or conceivably that the agency has determined shall have a party status. Because under present law, present law says each person or agency entitled as of a right to hearing before the agency, or named or admitted as a party. Under the present law, we say named or admitted as a party. I have characterized that as saying that the agency on its own initiative has said, we need this particular person, using the very neutral person in here. Well, that becomes a party. The agency you're talking about consolidating, saying that the agency is forcing somebody to give up his right to cross-examination, would the agency then be in trouble? I only then can come back to standard of review, because that's what we have to go to. When the court is looking at it, if the agency has made a decent effort to say, all right, now, constant cross-examination, make your point, get it to, let's get some order in this thing. The agency has not dealt with a technicality. The grounds of review of the agency order are very limited. Now we go back to 183.482, and particularly, order to be unlawful in substance or procedure, but error in procedure shall not be cause for reversal or remand unless the court shall find that substantial rights of the petitioner were prejudiced thereby. And as long as you have that limited standard of review, I find it difficult to believe that the court is going to reverse an order in which the agency had said, making a decent showing and showing good rationale for it, tell us what you want to cross-examine on, and how that distinguishes from what the prior cross-examination was. The answer is, I don't want to tell you, I just want to go fishing. Well, we feel that under our rules, you shall be specific. Well, I've got an absolute right. Well, then show us what prejudice you have suffered, so you've got to give us some basis. That's why I don't think that this distinction is going to make, I think it's a distinction without a difference when we look at what is being reviewed.
Okay, but we're all groping here, and what I want to satisfy myself about, and I think we have, is that we now at least have persons in a proceeding who are in two theoretically different positions. One is a party, and the other is an intervener. Intervener's rights right now, under existing law, are not the same as those of a party. But looking at the expanded definitions of 361, what happens is that there no longer is a distinction by definition between intervener and party. An intervener is someone who just happens to get there by saying, hey, I want in, as opposed to the agency saying, you're in. And therefore, all of the rights of parties, which are substantive or procedural rights in sections 415 and following, all of a sudden are matters of right.
Mm-hmm.
That may make it much more difficult to do the consolidation that we had the colloquy about earlier. Because if they say, damn it, it's my right to counsel, and I have a right to cross-examine, and it says I get to do it on all issues.
Yes. And my answer to that is, I find no problem in that. I would say this. Yes, damn it, I've got a right to cross-examination. The agency says, what is the relevancy of your cross-examination? I'm not going to tell you. Well, then you've got an error in procedure. What the court is going to say, if you're not going to cooperate in trying to get the data here, but merely stand on technical rights, you certainly show us where you were prejudiced when the agency gave you an opportunity to cross-examination, if you'd come forward with a relevant basis, or said, sure, you have a right to counsel, show us why you cannot join your counsel, why we can't do this orderly structure through the situation. I guess my answer to be, I don't find any problem with expanding an intervener to a party, because it's a very fancy distinction, which in the long run, one of the things that I've heard about this is, making fancy lawyer distinctions without giving people a chance to get ideas before the agency. Now, I see no problem with that idea. I see no problem with that proposition as long as the agency is also granted the position of saying, all right, you don't exercise your rights
in a vacuum, or you don't exercise your rights for the joy of making rights, you shall at least tell us what you intend to do with that right.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I have some other points, but I think other members of the committee might want to pursue some.
Do they relate to this segment of the bill or other segments?
My other questions relate to other segments.
Okay, why don't we take them as we get to those parts of the bill? Yeah, Representative Kim Gossett.
David, as I understand it, Al, would you contend that under sub A of the bill, that the agency would also have the authority to consolidate those parties, and you wouldn't treat the people under sub B any different? For, let's say that there
a
were...
A party you're talking about in the definition of parties.
Yes.
Each person or agency entitled as to right of hearing before you.
Okay, let's say there's 10 of those, and the agency says, I want you to consolidate. Do you think there's any problem? Can you distinguish between A or B on consolidation?
I don't know that I like particularly the word consolidation. I do think that what an agency should do, if it's getting a complicated process, and it has become aware that a lot of people are going to be in there, forcing to consolidate. I think an agency can, and Dick is probably in the more complex cases, say, all right, we've got this complex case. Your interests, each one of you people's interests is identified. Really, a pre-hearing conference, saying, what are you going to talk about? I think an agency has authority to make a party consolidate in the sense, or at least to define down what the issue is, what we're going to talk about. What evidence it's going to put on. Existing authority when it deals with the problem. I think I come back to the same answer that I gave to Representative Frohnmayer, that rights do not exist in a vacuum. Sure, you've got the right to operate as a party. Now, and certainly the agency is going to say, if you are a party, we want you to be able to cross-examine, put in as much evidence as possible, but the agency equally has the authority, I don't want to use the word right, the authority to set up an orderly procedure, which it should do in a complicated case. And if it makes a reasonable effort to do so, and maybe says, please make me a showing of why you can't consolidate. Well, I don't want to make a showing. I'm just going to say I don't want to. The agency isn't likely to get reversed
now,
if that's the response.
I can see that where you're talking that way, but the point is that A and B, and I think what David was saying is that under the A and B, you made them all the same. They're parties.
But what I'm saying is that what is the court going to review? Will the agency be turned around? If the agency has made a proper procedural steps, and the guy who said, I didn't get to do this, but cannot show any prejudice, but just because it's an abstract right that I want to play with, the court isn't going to reverse it.
Al, in light of this section, just one last question. In light of the way that you have the decision of the agency as far as the admission of parties, that it's not a final order, do you think as a practical matter, if one of the parties objects,
somebody else
standing, and the agency is contrary to that position, do you think as a practical matter they're ever going to prevail in an appeal on the admission?
No. That's the point I tried to make. I tried to make in the memorandum. That's the point I'm saying. Agency is going to say, if we go to a lot of work and we're err on admitting somebody who maybe we didn't have to, and some other party objects to that, we're not going to be reversed on that ground. More likely to be reversed on the ground of course, erring in not admitting someone who asked to come in.
So the practical effect
is open it up. But there's still, and you know, you could just say, you know, let it all hang out for grabs and let the agency take care of it there. But I think that there should be some power of the agency to say, oh, come on, fellas, you really have no interest in this.
Now, if that's going to be the practical effect, I think David's position on defining powers agency as far as consolidation is imperative. If you're
going to
have that many people, I think you've
got to
clarify that.
Here's what Marvette case says, I think, at this point. To avoid redundancy, agency may choose to require interveners to join one presentation or to address separate aspects of the public interest as long as the effect is not to exclude an asserted public interest altogether. Something like this was done in the interventions of Marbet and Christensen. In these proceedings, they accepted the restrictions on their testimony and cross-examination, and we find here no abuse of discretion by imposing conditions over an intervener's protest.
Now, I would argue that I don't think the court would find an abuse of discretion over abuse of discretion in controlling even parties' presentation. As long as the burden is placed upon the party of showing some substantial prejudice to their interest, which is the level of the court's review. That's why I don't find the intervener party distinction that much of a problem. I conceive of the agency, they can even say to parties. They can't say you cannot cross-examine, but give us a statement of the character of your testimony. Give us a statement of the character of your examination, and we will limit it. We propose to limit it to that, with an opportunity to say why you want to expand it. And if the party cannot show, the intervener, the party, the person cannot show where he's been hurt thereby, the court is going to say, so what? You've got to show some prejudice to your interest, not the esoteric exercise of a, quote, right, close quote.
Mr. Chairman. Now, I think it's clear that under 361, interveners, for people who are formerly interveners, have very much more dramatically expanded rights than I had thought on first reading of this bill, or than has generally been thought in the public press.
Yes.
I think, though, where I may take issue with you is the extent to which you think that the agency can cut the parties off on cross-examination and cut them off on their right to present evidence and cut them off in rebuttal. Because if you read 483.450(3), every party shall have the right of cross-examination of witnesses who testify and shall have the right to submit rebuttal evidence. Looking to 415(3), parties may elect to be represented by counsel and to respond and present evidence and argument on all issues involved.
Mm-hmm.
So whereas before you might allow a person intervention with respect to 2 of the 20 issues in the case, now they're a party and they get to talk about everything. Now, I just want to be clear that that's what you want.
And that's,
I make the issue about whether or not a court consistent with what standards of judicial review are going to be imposed will allow the agency to consolidate or cut off, because I'm not quite as confident.
I think the agency would be, I guess my only answer to that is the agency would be, should not be allowed, even with an intervener, once it's determined that the person has an interest in the outcome or represents a public interest, why should they be cut off if that cutoff procedure, and when we're cutting off, we're talking exclusively about procedure, not substantive. Why should the agency allow that person to be cut off if that cutting off interferes with a substantial, either the public interest they represent or a substantial right? I don't think you want that. Mr. Sandvik, I think my co-counsel is disagreeing with me. I don't think you'd want that. I don't think an agency would be well advised to. Certainly an agency is going to have to see to it that there is an orderly presentation. And that's going to be up to the agency's judgment. That's going to be up to the agency's capacity to analyze the issues before it, an opportunity to let anybody who it is has allowed to participate in there and say, okay, this is the orderly structure upon which we go. And if the agency does its job and puts the burden, and we come back again, and I think the agency is perfectly right to put the burden upon the party saying, I want to do this, of what relevance, of what nature is it that you want to do, what interest of yours is going to be affected. The courts are sophisticated enough to recognize the thing that I think you know, there's double interest on both sides of this, and I'm interested in, I just want to raise the devil before the sake of raising the devil so that I can take it to a court, because that's what I want to raise. The court's going to say, you've got, if you want to cross-examine, if you want the opportunity to cross-examine, the agency has the right to say, tell us the area in which you wish to cross-examine. Certainly, if it was an agency, it would be in bad error to say, letting somebody come in as a, quote, intervener, and then say, no, we won't let you present evidence on that point, relevant or not, because you're only an intervener.
Well, the point is, now they're a party, and there's no, right. There's no statutory basis for distinguishing between how you became a party as long as you are one.
I don't find it as much of a problem.
To that extent, then, the second sentence on 183.450 sub 3 is really redundant now.
Yes.
The sentence that reads, parties permitted to intervene by the agency shall have such rights as determined by agency rule or otherwise. The point is, there's no such person as an intervener now. You're a party or a zip.
Yes.
And if you're a party, you get everything.
Yes.
So that sentence, the agency can't by rule make now a distinction between those who got to be parties by virtue of intervention and those who got to be parties by virtue of being named.
My answer would be that's perfectly correct because of the change of the definition. We didn't amend 450 sub 3. May I feel on my right an argument to the contrary. But I don't know that that is going to make any difference. It doesn't preclude the agency from structuring and ordering the procedure, the proceedings that takes place before it. It does not preclude an agency from asking someone to, when they say, I want to take these procedural steps, what interest of yours is involved in following that procedure? And the agency would be poorly advised if the person, if the party asserting that situation made a showing of a substantial interest and they said, no, you're an intervener, you can't bring that up. It's a distinction without a difference.
Mr. Chairman, may I ask, at the risk of creating a schism in the Attorney General's office, whether Mr. Sandvik has a contrary view of any of these points?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not disagreeing with Mr. Lowy or Representative Frohnmayer in terms of the analysis, but I think that if it is the intention of the legislature in adopting Senate Bill 361 to make all parties equal for procedural purposes in terms of their right to cross-examine and their right to present evidence, it's very dangerous to leave the second sentence of 183.450 sub 3 in there. Because I think we know how these things happen. Some agency, represented by some assistant attorney general who hasn't gotten a word, will see the statute and say, hey, why don't you adopt some rules allowing consolidation of interveners? And some agency is going to do that, and I don't think all the legislative history in the world eliminates the risk of this sentence being used and ending up in a court situation sometime where an agency has tried to distinguish between interveners and other types of parties and ending up after a long administrative process, finding out they're doing something they could not do. I think that there is a risk of a problem if that second sentence stays in there, if nobody really intends that to be the law. I think right now, this sentence is the only one that really in the APA talks about intervention and sloppy draftsmanship or whatever. This sentence, I think, was in our minds, at least in my mind, that an intervener was a specific class of party. And they would have some limited rights. I guess there's two ways to deal with it, depending upon how you resolve the philosophical question of what rights interveners should have. You could take the top of page 3 of Senate Bill 361 and say any party requesting to intervene before the agency as a party can be allowed if the agency makes the determination. And then in the second sentence of 183.450, say parties permitted to intervene shall have such rights as determined. But I think the problem should be dealt with. There's a trap line. Maybe Mr. Lowry thinks
I'm
overstating
right.
Concern.
Well, either that or you define intervener separately than party, and then just leave the sentence as it is and allow the court to continue to give second-class citizenship if you want to be pejorative about it, or at least to continue to treat differently interveners and parties.
Well, I just wanted to raise one of the potential problems.
I think you're right. We have to deal with that sentence. Yes.
Just to clarify, are we all in agreement if this bill is adopted in its present form as to parties, that the concept of intervenors would no longer be present in the Oregon APA?
Well, the distinction between
the distinct parties. Distinction.
Well, unless you change 183.450, but go ahead.
I agree with the discussion Representative Frommeyer and Mr. Lowy had, that that distinction does disappear. The only reason I was raising the other matter was...
I don't know that the concept of intervener was very lively in the APA, in my experience with it, ever has been particularly. Now, intervener does appear in the siting facility, and you can create an intervener situation in a particular. We do have this one sentence of 183.450, but I've never seen it really been a problem, because I guess as a practical matter, most of the times the agencies will generally say, okay, you want to come in and talk, come in and talk.
I know that with the employment relations board, representation positions, they distinguish between 30% interveners, 10% interveners, and the rights of the two are substantially different as to who comes in and what role they play in the hearing. And I want to make I want to know if in fact that that's what this bill is going to do, is eliminate that, or is that going to still be allowed to exist?
Does that come out of the APA, or does that come out of ERB enabling?
Okay.
But I don't know.
Right. I think it comes out of enabling legislation for them. The 30%ers in the statute, the 10%er is something that they've come up to in
okay.
legislation.
That, again, you see, would be my answer. If you've given them specific authority to handle proceedings before them with the concept of intervener, this isn't going to change that. Would be my answer. Again, I'm off being a generalist. If the legislature has said in a particular kind of proceedings dealing with ERB statuses will be such and such and such and such, it'll prevail, of course, over the Administrative Procedure Act.
Further discussion on this particular segment of the bill?
Yeah. I have a question for you. If person requests standing as a party and the agency turns them down. Am I correct in understanding that the way the bill is drafted, including existing law, that a final order on the case that the party standing was requested for would have to be written before that person could challenge his refusal to standing as a party in court? Is that correct? And second question is, if one person is refused standing and they challenge that, do all the other parties in the case, or may all the other parties in the case participate, or is it a matter between the agency, that party, and the court? I'm trying to weigh the burden of delay where the appeal would be filed before the proceeding goes forward, or while the proceeding is going forward, or waiting for the whole case to be done. How many parties would be involved in which action, and where the most delay would be caused?
So, for my members coming on that, I guess that's a...
I think you correctly stated the issue. The issue is whether there is risk of greater delay and adverse burden by allowing the issue to be decided on an interlocutory basis, an immediate appeal, or whether you, in some sense, put a greater burden on the agency to do it right by saying, we'll upset the whole apple cart at the very end after you got your order, if you guessed wrong, which is the way it's now drafted.
David, she had one other question. She wants to know if, in fact, that you go opposite the bill and allow an appeal on the denial as an intervener, who appears, as a party, who gets to appear in the Court of Appeals on that issue? Does the agency and all the other parties, or is it just the party?
The other parties have standing.
Do they?
I don't think so. I think it's just the aggrieved, non-named party and the agency.
Since the agency makes the order, makes the decision whether the person is going to be a party or not, it would be the agency, but would there be anybody else is what she wants to know.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sorry to disagree with Representative Frommeyer, but I would say that... I would say that, depending upon, all right, take the interlocutory situation, and we have this occasion, that's because of the agency situation. We'll often have situations in which
another party, the agency, two or three parties in the agency are all talking in front of the Court of Appeals. We try to save money by sometimes by saying, okay, if somebody's going to represent the agency's position, why the Department of Justice won't make an appearance on behalf of the agency. But except that it isn't practical when you come, whether they've got standing or not, as Representative Myers asked earlier, or Representative Kulongoski, is the agency ever going to lose for having admitted someone in? And quite frankly, probably not.
That wasn't the context of my question, Mr. Chairman. It was the case where the party was not admitted to the proceeding.
Well, I guess that the answer to that, who would be arguing on what side? I'm the agency, of course, would defend its position before the court. If it had refused to allow someone to enter into the proceedings and that person ultimately came up and asked the court to review that determination, certainly the agency would be there, would be under the burden of defending its position before the court. Any other participants' participation in that, well, whether it would be a matter of right or a matter of amicus curiae, I don't know. I can't see the concern, I guess, what I'm saying is.
Is he just saying?
You might. If they came in, why would you waste a lot of time? I guess why would you waste a lot of time fighting on whether they had standing or not? Let them file their brief, make their point, let the court decide the issue.
I don't think it's a matter of any
moment. Al, I'd like to slip over to the chair for a moment. Senator Ford is here. Very brief comment on Senate Bill 2. We'll come right back to this bill. He will take it and get back to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Stephen Gaffori, Senate District Number 7. I guess I should say I support the bill and leave, making me very happy. I wanted to remind the committee that Senate Bill 2 did come out of the committee with every member of the Senate Judiciary Committee supporting it, except for one. We fought months and months and a lot of hard battles, but at the end we agreed that although none of us got what we wanted, the compromise that we came up with was much superior to law as it presently stands. And the concern that if we don't do it this session, we'll be back again next session doing it again, and back in 79 doing it, 81 doing it again. At some time we've got to do a revision of the juvenile code, and it might as well be this session. I wanted to express one of my concerns was in that that you not get carried away in amending the bill to meet possible objections until you find out that some people really do have a lot of objections, because what we found in the House was that the objections people had really were, it's too big a bill, or I got a call from a juvenile director in my county who said he doesn't like it. And if that's the problem, you can't really amend it to meet those people's needs or desires. I really think what you ought to do is to amend the bill to do what you think it ought to do, and then push for passage on whatever kind of things you can do, arm twisting or talking to people on its merits. But I don't think that amending the bill to satisfy people is going to accomplish anything. And if you go too far, you'll get in a situation where you might be pushing it to being worse than the law we have presently. A couple of things that I think are really important. I think a consent decree concept is something that the bill can be sold on, the idea that what we're trying to do is to save and protect families, that it isn't something, as has been charged by some of the opponents, that brings unnecessarily formalities, and I think quite the contrary, it tries to encourage informality. And the other issue that raised hackles in the Senate was one that was purely a case of misunderstanding. The bill originally, as you know, had a non-waivable right of attorney, and that, as you're well aware, has been taken out, and some people haven't quite got the message that's not there anymore, and they think that somehow we're forcing people to have attorneys when they ought not to have attorneys. My only concern is that the studies for in 1975 session, the Senate Bill 675, which did mandate non-waivable right of attorneys, it was a simple bill, that's all it did, it wasn't any juvenile code. the mandated non-waivable right of attorneys for juveniles. We found in studying for that that it didn't make, it made a tremendous difference which localities were in the state, whether you had a right of an attorney or not. And it seems to me that the issue is, if it should be waived, if there is such a thing as a knowing and intelligent waiver by a juvenile, then that ought to be, there ought to be some showing that it is, in fact, knowing and intelligent. If you don't have that, you're going to continue what we have in the state, and that is that juveniles in some parts of the state seem to be more knowing and intelligent than other parts of the state because the statistics are extraordinarily different in some parts of the state and other parts of the state of, as to whether they get attorneys or not. I think that's an important part. The concept of equal protection law is that everyone has a right to an attorney.
Okay. Thank you,
Mr. Thank you very much.
Let's go on to the next point.
All right, Mr. Chairman.
This is resuming session 3. We're going to probably run a little bit beyond that, but I would like to credit the presentation.
If I draw the committee's attention to page 6 of the bill, lines 6 through 15, this deals with the petition on judicial review.
Are you purposely going to 6? Have you been over 5? I'm sorry.
Really, because of the concepts, Senator, Representative, the concepts are better. These are contested cases. The other one on 5 is rulemaking. So if I could give a logical, even though it is not numerically in order. This amendment deals with the next question of, all right, we didn't, the interested person did not get in as a party, either didn't, never made the application, didn't know about it, wasn't aware, and suddenly becomes aware of an order of the agency and says, ah, I've got an interest in that and I want the court to look at it. What we've attempted to do here is that in the petition for asking the court to look at it, the person shall state whether they were a party. If they're a party, no question, they've got an absolute right for the court to judicially review. Or if they're seeking judicial review as a person adversely affected or aggrieved. And if they were not a party, but are saying, I'm adversely or affected or aggrieved by the order of the agency, even though I wasn't a party, they should set by affidavit to the court that they're asking to review, and Court of Appeals in this case, showing how they are so affected. And the court then, from the facts in the affidavit, shall determine whether or not they are an adversely affected or aggrieved person. If they are, the matter will proceed upon, if the court makes a determination, the matter proceeds on the same basis that any other judicial review of an agency order. If the court says no, you're not adversely affected or aggrieved, and there are pending other petitions for judicial review at that time, the same. We try to use the same context as the proceedings before the agency. The court itself will go on and make its ultimate determination on that review, and the question of whether or not someone who had asked and had not been will be reserved until after the final order, and then if, under the present structures I see now, if the Supreme Court wanted to take review, then that question would be reviewed later. I'd answer questions on this area. I think maybe something I should mention now, which has been brought up before, what can that individual raise as to the agency's order? It's a person who wasn't below. As I read this, I think there's no question about they can raise anything anybody else could have raised, because judicial review of agency order is limited by 183.482, which are errors in procedure, delegated authority, constitutionality, and substantial evidence. Those the agency did, those are the core things. If the agency didn't have substantial evidence to support its order, doesn't make any difference who raises it or whether they participated below or not. Agency must have substantial evidence to support the facts upon which its order is based. The statute is unconstitutional or not within the delegated authority. Again, it doesn't make any difference who raises that point. The agency, first of all, of course, cannot defy the Constitution, and number two, it can't go outside its legislatively delegated authority. So whether that's raised by somebody who's been a party all the way along the line or somebody who has been allowed to be admitted later makes little or no difference. And finally, the procedural sections of the court's review, which error procedural, not be caused for reversal unless it finds a substantial right of the petitioner were prejudiced thereby. So some talk in the early stages of 361 has been that attempt on 361 to keep people from drawing to the court's attention that the agencies were wrong. There is, I can only assure you that it certainly was not the intention of the drafting, and that anybody, if the court determines they're adversely affected or aggrieved, should certainly have the position to be able to point it out.
Appeal as a right extends to parties. Now, in a case like Marbet's right to appeal was on the basis, rather, his access to judicial review was on the basis of the affected or aggrieved standard.
Mr. Sandvik answers that one better.
Chairman, Mr. Marbet was a party to the agency proceeding, so he had judicial review as a right.
Now, does the affected or aggrieved portion of the statute dealing with judicial review permit someone who has not been involved in the proceeding at all at the agency level to seek to obtain judicial review?
Yes.
Under present law?
Yes.
Can you summarize for me in one or two sentences how this changed the present law?
Not very much. It only, probably the major thing that it does is whether that is appealable. Present law is very broad as to who seeks judicial review. That was reaffirmed in Marbet versus PGE. We attempted to think about how do we determine a person, do we set some standard? What is adversely affected or aggrieved? Again, we're dealing with a general statute. How do we know? The situations are as various as there are administrative agencies and administrative orders. So what we're not, I don't feel the language on page 5 is making any substantial change in existing law. We haven't had many cases in which people were that interested.
I would interpret the provision about, or I would understand the provision about supporting the affidavit and the separation of the issue of in effect standing to obtain appeal, separating that from the decision of the issues otherwise raised on appeal, that's new.
Yes, that is new.
At present, if a person seeks a review on a basis other than a review of right, the issue of that person's entitlement to review, as well as the issue of the decision of the issues raised, is all briefed and decided together. Is that correct?
Not necessarily, Representative Myers. I have on occasion moved to dismiss for lack of standing.
This
clearly separates. I've on occasion moved to dismiss for lack of standing. And generally what has happened to me on that one is that the motion is denied with leave to raise on briefing. So I... But that's
this
the court.
Forces the court to decide
this. Yes, forces the court to decide.
And then the last sentence, course determination should not be subject to review.
Yeah.
I would interpret that to mean that you could not seek certiorari from the Supreme Court on that issue until the rest of the case has been decided.
If there is another petition for review. Now, it might be that, you know.
Yeah.
Assuming that there is another, nobody else cared and didn't want it, why then, of course, that would then immediately, any other, we don't know.
I just am a little bit at a loss to understand policy reasons one way or the other for lines 14 and 15 of that amended section.
Again, the only thing I can say is a matter, you mean 14 and 15? All right, someone is denied. A
petition, there's a petition for files a petition for review, and on the face shows that they are not a party, that they, it's based upon their being an affected or aggrieved person. That same order is, a petition for review of the same order is filed by someone who was a party, therefore having the review as of right. Was our hope that if there was a petition of a review of right, that that would be briefed and the final decision would be made before the person who had not been allowed the petition for review could request the Supreme Court to grant review of the order not allowing them to petition for review. Same rationale as the denial, or this is the attempt to be the same rationale as the denial of authority to participate as a party, to be delayed at the until the final determination. And assumedly the same practical effect, that the court will in turn be more inclined to say, even with colorable showing, that sure, we'll review it.
Okay, the terms adversely affected or aggrieved, which recur several times throughout new subsection, rewritten subsection 2, are those terms of art?
No, I think they're just nice big generalities.
Now, they are, in the present statute relating to judicial review, other than parties.
Yes, if you look at...
sought by other than parties.
Mm-hmm. 480. Any person adversely affected or grieved by an order or any party to a proceeding.
Where do you see it, allied?
Oh, it's 183.480. Again, we didn't amend that. It's not in here. You'd have to look at the statute. This is 183.482.
Suppose you have a situation where the party petitions the court for review, and the court denies that. Another party is...
The court cannot deny a party's petition.
Can you have someone petition
for review? Other than a party.
Other than a party, and the court denies that. And you have a party petition for review, and the court decides the case on the merits. The party who was, the person who was denied petition for review petitions the Supreme Court on the grounds that they were wrongfully denied the right to petition.
Right.
Okay, the Supreme Court decides that they were allowed, they should have been allowed that right.
Yes.
Okay, what's the standing of the case at that point?
The Supreme Court denies it, allows it, they should have been allowed the right to petition for review. All right,
can
I think the next.
Can you determine that on a harmless error basis?
It could possibly, it might be on a harmless error basis. And the next thing that you're going to say, Supreme Court says, all right, you should have been allowed. They did judicially review it on the petition of some other person. What would you have brought to the Court of Appeals' attention that was not dealt with by the Court of Appeals in this its proceedings? And he might validly say, and again, I'm talking in generality, we'd have to get into a particularity, he might say, well, maybe nothing. Court of Appeals did look at it. Or he might say, this particular point was not raised to the Supreme Court.
So it's your point that at that point, once it determined that the person should have had the right to petition, they would then have the right to point out to the Supreme Court what it was that they would have brought out that the other party did not.
Yes.
Okay. Representative Lombard.
Is it your intention, by the language in here and relating to the affidavit, that oral argument would be foreclosed on...
Yes, I don't particularly. If the court, I get a little hesitant about telling the court whether it wants oral argument or not.
Say, what if the court does want oral argument? Would it be your intention that this would foreclose that?
I don't think so. I would
from the practice of the court, by affidavit, the language of affidavit there, the court may or may not order oral argument depending upon its own desire. Professionally, I'm not resisting any request of the court.
Do you have any more to offer?
The only other thing I wanted to mention, then, is the other aspect of the bill, which appears on page 5, lines 10 through 12. And this is merely thrown out. Some language of the opinion in Marvette versus Pebble Springs would conceivably indicate that when the legislature was in a rulemaking proceeding, as distinguished from a contested case proceeding, and this language I understand, as I interpret the language, appears to come from the Nuclear Siting Facilities Enabling Legislation, that the agency in rulemaking proceedings might be required to conduct evidentiary hearings. Now, what we have advised agencies over the last number of years is by rule of thumb, how do you distinguish between a contested case when you've got to have evidence and cross-examination, make findings of fact, or a rule situation where you are being legislative? Well, what does it feel like? If it feels like something that will be done in the court, it's probably quasi-judicial. If it feels like something the legislature would be doing, you're probably being quasi-legislative. And that consequently, you conduct your rulemaking in the same manner as this here. You put out the notice, you propose to adopt the rule, i.e. law, you try to get as many people to come in and testify before you, you listen to that input, and you're commanded by 183, by the rulemaking statute, to fully consider it, and then you adopt your rule, which is subject to judicial review on limited grounds. On page 5, lines 10 through 13, this may or may not accomplish what we desire, and it may or may not be the sense of the legislature. The adopted amendment or repeal of a rule by an agency need not be based upon or supported by an evidentiary record beyond the requirement of subsection 3 of this section, which in turn says that the agency shall provide opportunity for oral hearing if they have number of requests, and they shall consider fully any written or oral submission. As I say that,
Mr. Chairman, Representative Richards.
Can you tell me the legal definition of an evidentiary record? And before you do, I'll tell you what my concern is. On this page, you talk about a rule being a legislative activity and when you're adopting, amending, or repealing. But when you go back to the definition of rule in the beginning, it now includes boldface standard.
Mm-hmm.
So, with respect to, for example, the Energy Facility Siting Council, we're talking about the potential, are we not, of adopting siting standards which don't have to be based upon an evidentiary record. Could you tell me what the impact of that is?
Well, I think if I can understand this the best way, the siting standard of a particular site, of course, is to run as a contested, a particular, as against standard as a generality. Legislature passes a statute, it may also be a standard of conduct. That's what we generally consider it to be. Someone is charged with a violation of that statute in a particular factual circumstance. In order to sanction the individual or violating the statute, if we talk in the criminal terms or even in the administrative terms.
Could we use the Siting Council standard example? That might be more helpful for me since I have a little familiarity with that.
All right.
As opposed to criminal law.
Our understanding that the Siting Council, well, this is really what causes the problem. Our understanding that if the Siting Council adopts a standard generally, all shall have, there shall be a determination of economic interests, and the standards of economic interest shall be economic ability to construct, and they shall be. Not with Pebble Springs, not with any one, but in every case. Now, in Pebble Springs they didn't do it. They hadn't done it at that point. But that's like adopting a statute. If, however, in the course of a particular site, i.e. Pebble Springs, they say, we adopt the financial standard based upon such and such, the evidence before us, that's an evidentiary record.
Is there a differentiation between two kinds of standards in the legislation?
No, I have never. An agency may adopt a rule, as Representative Frohnmeyer was pointing out, the Marbet decision, may, in the course of a contested case proceedings, adopt a general standard. In all cases like this, we will do so. Or it may adopt a general standard not within the context of a particular proceeding.
Mr. Chairman, can I try again?
Try again, Mr. Richards.
Is there any case, as regards the energy facility siting council, either a specific site standard or a general standard, in which, is there an evidentiary record required in any standard-setting case that the Energy Facility Siting Council might undertake? Either specific or broad, the adoption of a standard, is there any case in which an evidentiary record now is required under the language of this bill?
That's what I don't know about the Supreme Court opinion. Under this bill, no.
There's
it would
no record
not in a generality, but an evidentiary record under these amendments would still be required if you were dealing with a specific site. But under these amendments, when they adopt the general legislation,
the equivalent of legislation, no evidentiary record would be required. But maybe Dick can answer that one better because it's his.
Representative Frohnmeyer. Al, would you object to language that would begin subsection 11 that said something effective unless otherwise specifically provided by statute, now on adoption?
I wouldn't find that objectionable because I'm clearly of the opinion that in any specific area, the legislature can and may certainly desire to say you will make findings before you adopt a general rule. My concern
is. I can think of a couple enabling statutes and a few on relatively minor matters already this session in which rulemaking is not only by 183, but the substantive statute imposes additional requirements on agencies, which could be construed to be require finding of fact.
Yeah,
which is how I read Marbet anyway.
Yeah, that, and I read Marbet that way too. My problem with Marbet is advising agencies. The Marbet opinion, I don't know. You know, is that retroactive?
Well,
since we've
I read Marbet as saying that the requirement for any findings, if there is any such requirement, comes from Chapter 469, not from Chapter 183. And I gather you want to make the APA specific, so that it's absolutely clear that those statutes that are silent on the matter result still in legislative type rulemaking hearings.
Right, and that the legislative rulemaking type hearings for the generality, and that there would just be a specific statement that you shall.
I think that's sensible policy, but I would prefer to see the modifier ahead of the sentence. I want to ask you one other question, Mr. Chairman. You said that it needs to be supported by an evidentiary record beyond the requirements of subsection 3 of this section, but subsection 3 does not speak about an evidentiary record at all, Al. And the question is, what does the agency take up on judicial review as to whether or not its rulemaking proceeding is adequate?
Oh, well, it's judicial review of its rulemaking proceedings so far.
No, it says needing the evidentiary record beyond the requirements of subsection 3. But if you look back at subsection 3, you have to deduce from subsection 3 what the record might look like for purposes of shipping it up to the Court of Appeals to say you did your rulemaking all right. And that's do you have to send up a text of all the written and oral submissions?
No.
You have to send up. Well, why not?
We have it. Well,
because
the only thing
it says nothing beyond the requirement of 3, and 3 says that you shall fully consider any written or oral submission, and so one might argue then that you have to have a record what those submissions were in order to show you fully consider it.
Well, as of the present time, we've got one opinion that says you don't have to. Now, that, which review was
okay,
denied.
But since this
changes
after that, I think we need a subsection that says what the record of a rulemaking proceeding is under those circumstances, just to obviate the possibility that can arise?
I don't even know, quite frankly, Representative Frohnmayer, I don't even know how well I'm going to stand on that one, because that same question is, International Shopping Centers versus DEQ, the court accepted the record as being evidence that the notice was published in the Secretary of State's bulletin, that a copy was sent to the Legislative Council Committee, and that the rule was published in the Secretary of State's bulletin upon adoption. And the court said that's a sufficient record. The Court of Appeals did. Supreme Court denied review for the purposes of the Administrative Procedure Act. The Supreme Court denied review of that. Let's see, it was a motion to supplement the record, which the court denied the motion, and so that was reviewed. Now the question is going to be before, again, under the DEQ statute, and certainly with the Marbet decision, whether or not in secondary site, secondary pollution sources, the enabling statute, whether there's sufficient to be a sufficient record, and I can't determine. I don't know the outcome of that one yet.
Well, but you see what I'm driving
at? Yes.
I think that we, by the language that says nothing beyond the requirement of subsection 3, where subsection 3 doesn't speak of record requirements, it ought to be clear. And I say that for a additional reason, which is that we've not talked about...
Supported by an evidentiary record, period. There was a redraft before the Senate of the first proposed amendment, and I must say that so when I was redrafting, I put in that cross-reference primarily to call people because of testimony that had been before Trade and Economic Development that certain people were concerned that the agency wouldn't consider inputs or the views written in data. So I tried to say, okay, this is what you need to do. I would be even to show that cross-reference. I wouldn't mind eliminating everything after by an evidentiary record, period.
The other problem is Senate Bill 526 passed, and I think it's on the governor's desk, if not signed, which deals with additional procedural requirements expected of agencies, you know, along the line of showing need or whatever. And by passing this bill, which doesn't refer to that, it's no longer wipe it out because of that new constitutional amendment. But I think that the procedural effect of 526 in terms of what has to be in the record for judicial review of rulemaking procedures probably ought to be spelled out, because I think there's quite a conflict between the two statutes, or at least an ambiguity.
I'm both aware of, but I really haven't studied the interrelation of 526 in this.
Further questions? Joyce?
I work for Representative Myers, generally reviewing the technical aspects of any bill, and I just have a couple questions. First of all, this may be a little repetitious of what you were just talking about. Isn't it true that standards often are more specific than an agency directive or a regulation, such that in the subsection 7 on page 3, where you include standards in the rulemaking procedure, isn't it more reasonable sometimes to use an adjudicatory procedure when you're imposing standards if those standards aren't quite narrowly applied?
Yes, I think so. And I, as I was saying to Representative Frohnmayer, I just would hope that that would be a specific within particular enabling legislations of particular agencies. And that if the, because we've been building agencies for 30 years and we've been giving them a regulatory authority for 30 years. And certainly if the legislature says you will go and make a factual determination before you adopt a rule, that would definitely prevail. But the legislatively delegated rulemaking authority over the 30, 40 years or beyond comes in a variety of forms. And my major concern is I've got an awful lot of rules out there, none of which have ever been based upon an evidentiary record. I have grave difficulty figuring out which one should, what do we go back to. Now, there's a lot of people, and I sometimes am one of them, who probably figure that the elimination of a lot of agency rules would be a very handy thing to have, but as long as that's the system we're operating on, the reason we were requesting the including of standard is unless there's a clear, specific direction from the legislature that an agency shall hold an evidentiary
hearing, that is, witnesses under oath with evidence in the record and evidence to support its ultimate determination, that the standard of the method of adopting rules is the same as this, and there's no evidentiary hearing held here.
Okay, fine. Sounds like you pretty well hashed that out. The other question I had was on page 6. In the amended language there, is it the intent to say that only persons personally affected can enter at the appeal level?
A person adversely affected or aggrieved by the agency order. And that's what the language says, because that's echo of the, that deals with what the petition shall contain. Existing law already, the Administrative Procedure Act says that 183.480, any person adversely affected or aggrieved should view as a person adversely, as a person adversely affected or aggrieved by the agency. You mean personally affected as distinguished from representing a public interest. I don't think that's the intention there at all.
The intention then is that a person interested in public interest could enter at the appeal level.
If they make a showing to the extent that they are adversely affected or aggrieved. That's a little, it's narrower than entering at the level before the agency. Because the language in admission as a party before the agency has an interest in the outcome of the agency proceeding or represents a public interest in such results. It's, I would say, somewhat narrower. But it's fairly broad as interpreted by the, it doesn't change the language in the Marbet decision. Of course, Marbet decision doesn't go to that because Marbet was a party before the agency.
Then, in a similar circumstance as Marbet, then could a party who, or a person who is a party as a public interest party before the agency re-enter on different grounds as a person adversely affected under this language?
A party can get review as of right, no matter whether they went in as a public interest or an individual interest. And as I was trying to point out earlier, the character of the review isn't going to change no matter how you came in, because the character of what the court looks at is not the standing of the individual. The court only has, the court has certain legislatures told the court how it looks, and that's in 183.482. It looks to see if the procedures have been followed, if the statute is constitutional, if the agency is acting within its legislatively delegated authority, and if there is a substantial evidence to support the factual determinations. If that's brought up by John Doe, it doesn't make any difference. I guess what I'm trying to say is it doesn't. The legislature says the court will look, and those are the four core areas of review of agency order.
Further questions of the witness, person of views?
I'm, of course, not an attorney, and I'm learning less and less about administrative law.
So am I.
As I listen to you, so I'll let you know something about it. What would you think of an amendment to your black type on page 5 that read something like this? The adoption, amendment, or repeal of a rule by an agency shall be based upon or supported by an evidentiary record.
Shall be?
Shall be.
I
always thought it was, I'll tell you frankly, until 40 minutes ago, sitting here. I thought that was the case.
When an agency is adopting a rule, it goes through the same steps and procedures, or we have always advised them, it goes through the same steps and procedures that this committee does when it deals with a statute.
That's true.
Well, maybe I'm not reading the same definition into it. The words evidentiary record. What do you identify as evidence?
Evidence is statements by witnesses given under oath, subject to cross-examination.
Don't you send your recorded record of the agency up on the appeal?
If it's a contested case hearing in an order, yes. But if it's a review of a rule, no. if a person is found guilty of the traffic infraction of over 55, the evidentiary record of that individual conduct and the determination that they had exceeded the 55-mile speed limit, when it's reviewed by a court, goes to the court. The legislature adopts a statute that says no one shall exceed 55. There's no evidentiary record underlying that general determination. It's only the specifics in which the evidentiary record lies. The legislature can say to agencies, as I've tried to point out this, throughout this, yes, you can say to.
You've got to carry a bill.
But I'm only saying it's a lot easier to advise agencies if we know the specific areas in which you are saying you make an evidentiary record before you adopt a rule.
You would oppose this, my suggestion?
No, I can't say I'd oppose, but I'd certainly like to have an opportunity to ask you to please refine upon it, because that nice generality will come.
Well, does... How about supported by such evidentiary record as was made by the agency?
Well, no, it shall be supported, but doesn't that kind of go in a circle? If the legislature wants to say, before the agency adopts a rule, it shall make an evidentiary record and make determinations of, and then of what? That's where I will, what shall we find out? What will the Barber's Board do?
You find that the evidence supports your decision.
Decision that...
Your rule. All right, let me be specific. To close the fishing season, or open the fishing season partially on the coast, which I know a little about.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the evidence supported, in my judgment, didn't support what they did recently.
What would the evidence be? That people would come in and testify?
A lot of people testifying, the federal orders, federal agency upon which they were supposed to be acting in concert, or with which they were supposed to be acting, a whole bunch of stuff. Quite a bit of evidence.
How long a hearing was it?
14 hours.
14 hours.
Yeah.
And if, and I say again, I'm not saying I wouldn't oppose it, but I'm only asking that it be done in specifically. Certainly, the legislature can say prior to the closing of the...
Well, excuse me, I don't mean to try to rework the entire law, Mr. Chairman, if I can continue. What are you talking in 335 only about a rule?
Only about rules, not about orders in contested cases.
Okay, but then when it becomes a contested case, you challenge the rule first, right?
You can, in the context of a contested case,
challenge the rule. Then,
or you can challenge the rule independently.
Okay, but we challenge the rule. Let's say we want to object to an order they just established. We challenge the rule. The agency says, well, we looked over our stuff. We're sorry. We disagree with you. Okay. Then when can I introduce the evidence?
Well, if you're in a contested case situation...
You're in court.
You're in court. The basis of challenging the rule is it's not within their delegated authority, or the rule itself is unconstitutional, or the statute upon which it's based is unconstitutional.
Down in 403.
Yeah, in 183, 400.
You don't have to have any evidence in that situation. It's just like the legislature. We can, as long as we allow people to testify for us, we can make a decision.
Yeah, I'm having trouble keeping my thoughts sorted whether or not you're talking about quasi-judicial or quasi-legislative, and I guess that's forever the problem in an administrative body.
Representative Bradford.
Well, I think the problem is that this language has created an impression in some members of the committee that there's no record of this hearing kept because it says need not be supported by an evidentiary record. So I think that some people feel that there's no record kept. Maybe you could clarify that.
There is no requirement that an agency keep a record. Most agencies, if they do hold public hearings on rulemaking, will keep a record, depending upon the character. Many of them, no, nobody really cares. You know, we often have rulemaking hearings in which we have a party and nobody comes. It's just based upon the agency's expertise. I know it's a broad I know it's a broad area, but there is no particular record. I have told agencies, and I'll be perfectly candid about it, that they may propose the adoption of a rule, hold a public hearing, and 150 people can come in and say that's a lousy rule, we shouldn't adopt it, and nobody comes in and says, yes, it's a good rule, and they can still adopt the rule in the form they want because they're relying upon their expertise.
Representative, yeah, Al, everybody's anxious to get down to the floor.
Sure,
I've got to ask you this while we're on the point because it's something I've always been curious about. The APA does impose a minimal obligation on the agency in a rulemaking proceeding, irrespective of whether or not there has to be a record. It says the agency shall fully consider such written or oral submission. Now, there is, I suppose, a theoretical argument that how the hell do you know whether they fully considered it, which is a judicial or reviewable question, unless there is some sort of record and they made findings.
Not representing ProMire.
No, nobody's ever raised that issue, so far as I know.
Hugh Smith has raised it. Hugh Smith and I have discussed it at great length.
Good point.
Okay. To worry about. Further questions to the witnesses? Thank you, Jim.
Don Wagner.
Wagner isn't here, but I'll do the best I can with asking.
Okay.
Is Mr. Connie to hold another hearing?
I don't believe we're going to hold another hearing on this. We need to hold a work session.
DJ Seymour, Oregon Environmental Council, and I hope you can hear me. I apologize for my voice as best I can do. Our concerns are primarily in the area that Representative Frohnmayer was raising question in at the beginning of this hearing, namely that of whether a person can intervene, whether the agency could, for instance, decide arbitrarily, no, you can't intervene, and you're ruled out. We question whether this bill will do what it was apparently intended to do in speeding up proceedings if, in fact, you wait till you get all through and then you have to throw out the whole works and start over from scratch. We tend to think it would be better if you could go in at the beginning and get that resolved, that question of intervention.
E.J., I'm going to have to interrupt you. We'll call the House. We'll be back as soon as the call is taken off. House Committee on Judiciary will come to order. The clerk will note those members present, the balance are excused. We're hearing Senate Bill 361. And Mr. Wagner, would you like to come up and tell us about that?
Okay.
Very briefly, I hope.
Yes, indeed. I think she's already explained the concern on page 3, lines 3 through 5, where we would like to see the words, the agency's determination is subject to judicial rule in the manner provided by ORS, et cetera, deleted. And
I understood her to say that she wanted a prompt determination on that question.
She wanted, okay, is that what she was saying?
Yeah, she said,
all right.
Can a person intervene or can the agency bar, and she'd like that resolved early. So I took that to mean she wanted an appeal from an interlocutory appeal.
Now, I'm not an attorney. I know you are, and I don't know. We would want it promptly resolved, yes. And the thing that concerns me is the final order, which sounds as though it's completely after everything is done. So, all right. The other thing which we were concerned about was on page 5, lines 10, 11, and 12, we felt those should be in exactly as they are. There should be no change.
Page 5, like 10, 11, and 12.
10, 11, and 12.
That should be remain in, huh?
Just as it is. Either that or take out the whole thing. But it sounds as though, to us, as if you start to play with it, you're apt to lose your ability to go back to the hearings, the local hearing, or the oral hearings. Okay. Then, I think one of the main concerns we have is on page 6, line 7, following proceeding, should be inserted, was denied status as a party. and in line 9, take out latter and put in last. Now, the reason for this is it appears that otherwise, if you are denied status as a party over here in page 3C, and you're saying that you have a public interest, that's why you're there. Then you come over here when you're petitioning, unless you put in was denied status as a party, then you have to prove that you're adversely affected or aggrieved, which means you have a public, a private interest rather than a public interest. So it seemed to us that that was a problem. And then on line 10, following order, the last of that, substitute and then a little B and before in line 11. Surely.
Do you
yes.
have either of these amendments written out or any?
I can write them up. I have them marked up. I can present them tomorrow morning if you would like.
Can you write them up this afternoon?
Yes, I can.
In handwriting, you can duplicate that. And
certainly can. Will.
So rather than mess around another day, if
surely.
There's some urgency about acting on the bill.
Yes.
The bill will not be acted upon today.
Okay.
Probably tomorrow.
Okay. Whom should I give them to?
Committee clerk or Dennis.
Okay, you're the committee clerk? Huh? Fine, I will
and I
do that.
Think it would be useful, Don, if you could, to give them to Al Lowy and to give them Mr. Black ahead of time so that we can all be responsive to the concerns.
You want Mr. Black?
Yes, I'm Mr. Black.
Okay, good. Fine. And the other person is
Al Lowy of the Attorney General's office.
Is he here or no?
He was here, he's not here now.
I should take them to his office then?
Yeah.
Okay, fine. I will be happy to do that.
Further questions to the witness? Thank you, sir.
Okay, thank you.
Is there anyone else here to testify on Senate Bill 361?
Mr. Chairman, I'm Jarvis Black, representing Portage Electric Company.
I'll take just a minute of your time. The issue of this, a person, has been raised by two of the witnesses, and I think that is resolved by the definition of person on page 3, beginning on line 6. A person includes any public or private organization of any character other than an agency. So I think that would carry an organization with a public interest would be included within the definition of a person. Representative Frohnmeyer, you mentioned to Mr. Lowy whether or not he had any objection to an amendment on page 5. Beginning on line 10. And I would concur in that amendment. If I'm not in order in asking this question, you please tell me. Do you have any additional amendments to this other than the one you asked Mr. Lowy about? And
well, I think that something needs to be done with 183.450 sub 3 now, because that does seem that's not in the bill.
Oh.
But it does speak to the rights of interveners.
Yes.
And we've got to decide as a committee, up or down, whether or not there are we're going to have parties separate than interveners, or whether all interveners are the same as parties, in which case language referring to interveners not only becomes redundant, but becomes confusing.
Yes.
So I think that 183.450 sub 3 will have to be amended either by striking the second sentence, or the bill will have to be amended by separating out the definition of party and intervener, and allowing the agency to set different rules for interveners than it does for parties.
Okay.
That's a technical defect in the bill as it's written. Then I was proposing that adding the language on page 5, to which you referred.
Yes.
Adding the words, unless otherwise provided by statute.
Yes.
Then, in addition, the language supported by an evidentiary record beyond the requirement of subsection 3, either strike those words, or perhaps more preferably specify what it is that must be, that is part of the record in a rulemaking hearing on judicial review, which in my judgment would be, you know, evidence to show that you notified people, et cetera,
yes.
et cetera.
Yes.
Although we've got that confusing thing about the agency's obligation to fully consider which has always been confusing to me and may be a ripe point for litigation by parties at any point. And I guess I want to think through a little bit more what I think of the last of lines 14 to 15 on page 6. Those are all of the only amendments that I would now contemplate necessary. I mean, I still want to make my mind on that last sentence.
Well, I appreciate your advice me as to what your thinking was and give me opportunity to think it over too. And did I, Representative Gardner, you say be hearing in the morning?
I have the understanding of Representative Myers that this will be carried over to tomorrow's agenda for work session.
Oh.
And I assume that it would come up in the morning.
All right.
Because you should check.
Fine. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We support the bill generally.
Is there anyone else to testify on Senate Bill 361? If not, we'll close the public hearing on the bill, and we'll stand adjourned until 7 o'clock this evening.
Can you think of a definition of record for purposes of judicial review of rulemaking?